past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's a delight to welcome back to the Morning Show Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country, and someone who joins us again every month to offer his own analysis and perspective on a range of different issues and topics and concerns. And there's quite a long list of things to talk about this time around. So without too much in the way of further introduction, we will simply welcome Professor Sear back to the Morning Show. Dr. Sear, glad to see you once again.
Well, thank you very much for having me back, Greg.
And I think one of the things we need to begin with is the demonstrations that we have seen across the country collected underneath the banner, at least loosely speaking, of Black Lives Matter, demonstrations that, of course, began quite dramatically in the Twin Cities and spread to major cities across the country. And for that matter, even small cities, both Kenosha and Racine, saw demonstrations as well. I suspect that when you look at these kind of events, I can tell from our past conversations that you're more inclined than maybe a lot of us are to put these kind of developments and events in historical perspective and context. So how would you compare what we have seen over the last few weeks compared to similar outbreaks and demonstrations in American history? Does this seem very much the same, or does this seem different in any significant way and perhaps marking a kind of a turning of a corner, perhaps?
Current activity is quite recent, of course, and we'll see if it becomes sustained. We live in a time where things tend not to be sustained in terms of public activity. The civil rights movement was very sustained, and from a very young age, I had the opportunity to live through that. It went from the 1950s, certainly through the very turbulent 1960s, and through much of the following decade as well. There is no distinctive figure that's emerged, I don't think, like Dr. Martin Luther King. However, Dr. King himself was not seen as a distinctive figure at the time. And the personalities involved are very much different. The 60s were characterized by very high crime rates across the board. We went from a period from the 50s through the 80s when this country had extraordinarily high violent crime rates for reasons. There are lots of explanations, especially from activists and professors. I don't think anybody knows exactly why we had this experience in that part of the 20th century. But since the early 90s, violent crime has been quite low. The 60s were a time of considerable turbulence, not just in terms of civil rights, but also, as I say, violent crime and also very destructive urban riots, which were not conflated with the civil rights movement by the media. And in all those ways, the current period, I think, is very different. But we'll see. We'll see if it's more than just a flash in the pan. And the latest, I don't minimize the violence, especially those who were hurt and killed, but we'll see if it's more than just the latest media sensation and social media sensation, or it actually lasts.
One way in which it does seem different is, my recollection is that past demonstrations weren't necessarily focused quite so singularly on the matter of policing and police brutality and police mistreatment of minorities, for instance, that what you were citing in terms of the civil rights movement were demonstrations that were, in a sense, much more diffuse or more comprehensive in their tone and the concerns that they were raising. And this feels like something that is maybe a bit more narrow in its focus, although certainly not entirely focused in that direction. But does that strike you as well as a difference?
Not really. You're right that there's a lot of narrow focus on police abuses, and it's not surprising. And in many ways, I think that's a very good development. But complaints about the police, is not just in urban environments, but in the rurals, in the South, especially the rural South, were a big motivating factor in the civil rights era, especially when police departments were a good deal less professional in the U.S. than they are today. It was a very, very different context in that sense. But no, emphasis, controversy concerning the police and emphasis by activists on the police is a problem. That's nothing new.
Hmm. What about some of the rhetoric that we sometimes hear around these current demonstrations that basically like to say, here we are, here we're still here, nothing has changed, we've made no progress whatsoever. I've seen plenty of commentary that would suggest that, for instance, since the beating of Rodney King, here we are, this is continuing to happen, we've made no progress whatsoever. I suspect you would take issue with that kind of pronouncement. Typically you like to point to progress that we tend not to be fully aware of. Is that the case in this instance as well?
Well, I think that in terms of daily life, there's a good deal more integration and federally enforced equality in the law than was the case in the earlier period that you and I are discussing. For listeners who may not be as familiar as you and I are with the Rodney King case, that was a case during the George H.W. Bush administration when an African-American was arrested. It became a very violent incident, and it was caught on video and on tape and touched off a lot of controversy in the U.S. In that regard, I think some of the most helpful and productive sources of education and information and insight into different periods of time are the addresses that our presidents, meaning of the United States, made to the nation during particularly difficult periods. And I think George H.W. Bush's speech to the American people and the action he took at the federal level following the Rodney King beating and then the very large-scale riot in Los Angeles that followed is very well worth. You can find just about anything on YouTube, including presidential speeches. I would commend that to people who are really serious about then and now. Dwight Eisenhower was first airborne to go to Little Rock, Arkansas to keep the peace and enforce the Supreme Court decision in 54, Brown versus the Board, and follow-up federal court decisions integrating schools in the South. And John F. Kennedy's speech to the nation finally after the enormous march on Washington led by Dr. King in the summer, I think August of 1963. That's a good way of placing the present in context. I'm very proud of the fact that we have a minor in African American studies at Carthage College now. I think it's particularly promising in African studies. I think it will help our African American education and efforts on campus. But in connection with that effort, I visited the Carter Center in Atlanta a couple of years ago. I used to get there fairly regularly on business, and I spent some time in the U.S. Army in Georgia many years ago. And I know the city fairly well. You see mixed race couples in Atlanta, and not just young people, and not just perhaps a stereotypical combination, but you see in daily life integration in the South. Now, that's not the rural South, but it's a huge change from the past. I had never worked with or really been with African Americans, with a few exceptions, until I was in the U.S. military. Officers, even in uniform, had to be very careful about socializing off post if it happened to be a black and a white. You were in serious trouble, and not just in rural Georgia. The Klan was recruiting among enlisted men. They had a goddamn billboard very prominently displayed just off post. All that has passed away. So we're hardly living in nirvana or heaven or total equality of opportunity, and we probably never will. But compared to direct experiences in that early time, yes, things are a lot different today. And statistically, we do have an African-American middle class and growing wealth. We also have a growing divide between rich and non-rich, and not just among the African-American minority in this country. But statistically, you can certainly see measurable progress in the last half century.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. This is his June visit to the morning show. We're touching on a number of different matters and issues. And of course, right behind the demonstrations that we have just now been talking about is the matter of COVID-19. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is the fact that in terms of mainstream media, one thing that we see very, very little of is coverage of COVID-19 in other countries. And of course, at the outset of all of this, the media was mostly talking about the terrible things happening in China and Italy and Spain and other places. And of course, once COVID-19 reached our shores and began doing serious damage, it's kind of fascinating how quickly COVID in the rest of the world receded from our attention. I suspect, as someone who's a real student of the world, you've been probably probing for information beyond the headlines most of the rest of us see, and have at least some sense of how the rest of the world is coping with this challenge.
Well, I'm impressed by the fact that you're always drawing contrast between you and me. I think it's a compliment, I hope, I think, I don't know. But yeah, if you look beyond the immediate headlines, and one thing that we have today that we didn't have way back in the 60s, which even initially focused our conversation on, is the 24/7 media cycle, which isn't really a news cycle, it's a media cycle driven by profits, not by spreading calm information. And that makes a very big difference. And maybe that encourages this kind of obsession with ourselves. The United States is so big in every way, including resources and the strength of our economy, that not only historically, but currently, if we want to, we can ignore the rest of the world more than other people can. So I'm very glad you asked that question, I think. Serious media, the BBC, the Wall Street Journal, I think, The Economist, the weekly published by the British that I've read every week since I was in grad school, and I'm glad I do. If you look, you can find useful information on what's going on elsewhere, and the World Health Organization and the UN more generally, but the WHO, current media and political target of President Trump, they actually have a lot of specific information on what's going on in the world.
Yeah. So what is your sense of this conundrum that we face, and of course, essentially every economy on the planet faces, namely the pull between being safe, trying to flatten the curve and so on, versus reopening the economy, getting back to some semblance of normal function, not just for the sake of morale, but for the sake of our institutions and the well-being of our economy. Those are two considerations that are in some, those are two considerations that are in tension with each other. How would you assess the way America has handled this question of opening, reopening, loosening restrictions versus trying to be careful and cautious? What's your impression of how these decisions are being made thus far?
I think overall we've handled it well. We've handled it responsibly. We haven't been nearly as efficient or effective as our friends in Germany or South Korea or Taiwan and probably even Hong Kong. But those are quite small and relatively homogeneous populations, geographically much smaller, far less diverse in every way than our population. I do think they set a fine example. I think given the nature of American society as well as the characteristics of our country, we've done fairly well. I know you've been much concerned about this problem, as we all have been. I'm not being a Pollyanna in any way, but the fact that we've been able to react with stay-at-home orders, in effect putting a burden on our economy as well as our society, shows just how wealthy and effective this country is. The media, just like the Great Depression, is constantly brought up as though nothing happened between then and now. The 1918 pandemic is regularly referenced as though nothing has happened since then. As you indicated, I'm an older person, and I'm old enough to have been around in the 60s, which you focused on. We had the Hong Kong flu in 1968-69, which was a very, very serious public health problem. American soldiers and others returning from Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War spread the virus very quickly, and over 100,000 Americans died during that period. We had to spend a period of time in the hospital, including, I believe, some days in intensive care. That was something you had to live with. We didn't have pervasive electronic communications. We didn't have the military. The internet was around, but it was a monopoly of the U.S. military, which had developed it, thanks to DARPA and the Pentagon. We did not have the luxury, if you will, of doing what we're able to do now. If you wanted to make a living, and the vast majority of people had to work for a living, you had to get a paycheck in order to survive with your family, and you had to go to work, and that's something you did. When you look at photographs and read about the time, there were health workers and other workers in public places were wearing masks, but we couldn't engage in the extraordinary kind of change and wrenching kind of change that we've done today. I hope that's reassuring to you, Greg. I know that this has been a great concern to you, and that comes through every time we talk, and not just on the air. So in that sense, you know, it's very mixed, as you pointed out quite perceptively in the past. There, globalization has its pluses and it has its minuses. But thanks to the enormously integrated high-tech economy and society we live in today, we've been able to respond to this virus, which is a function of globalization, though not new, in a way that's been quite effective. And the scare stories in the media, we have not, in fact, run out of ventilators. We have not, in fact, had people dropping dead in the streets because the hospitals are jammed. All the scare stories, that's why your job is so important, right? All the scare stories in other media have not come to pass. This country, I'm getting email for high fashion face masks. I don't know why. A good share of it seems to me to be better directed perhaps towards other female customers, but the ability of the Americans especially to develop, create, market, and sell is quite extraordinary.
I would say some of the more dire headlines, it kind of depends on where you are. I mean, if you had been in New York City at certain points during this crisis, or Seattle, Washington, there have certainly been places where COVID has been an extremely serious problem, and where health workers were taxed to the very limit, and with insufficient protective equipment for our healthcare, we're forced to recycle rather than dispose because there weren't enough to go around. So, but I think you're right that the media has probably painted a picture in which this was a danger that we all imminently faced, and that was not a proper representation probably of the risk that we were confronting at that point.
Well, turnabout is fair play. I knew you were going to bring that up, so that's one reason why I was reassuring, but I don't want to be overly so. But we are living in a better time today. Tom Clawson, our graduate and a very generous benefactor and very accomplished senior executive, an alum of Carthage College, he liked to express himself in very blunt, direct statements. I'm sure that quality became more pronounced as he moved up the corporate ladder. My favorite Clausenism was the good old days have not yet arrived. It's one reason I brought up the Hong Kong flu. I mean, disease was part of life. One of my earliest, most frightening memories as a small child, I had to have surgery because of a congenital problem. And I have a very clear memory of my dad coming to the hospital to pick me up and holding my hand as we walked out, and we had to go through the polio ward.
Mm.
And my child's memory, in any case, is these endless, terrifying iron lungs, big, huge metal machines, especially to a kid, holding each one a human being who couldn't live without the iron lung. And an awful lot of them were small. They were more small children, my age or younger. Just absolutely horrible. When Jonas Salk and associates developed the Salk vaccine, President Eisenhower had him to the White House in 1955, and it was a very emotional public ceremony. Ike, a grandfather, as he mentioned, teared up briefly, an unusually cold-blooded politician, if I may say so. Now, the American people collectively were moved by this, a huge accomplishment. Polio's gone.
Hmm.
The last case of smallpox in the U.S. Measles and chickenpox still appear, but not much. Smallpox has not been in our country since 1949, with other problems that ended in 45. But, you know, these scourges that were part of human life, they're gone. And I was telling one of our fine colleagues in the administration who wanted to talk to me about this, and she was quite obviously upset long-term about this. You know, I made this point without being, you know, too academic, I hope, we're talking. Compared to even the recent past, we're quite secure in physical terms, in pure public health terms, and especially in this country. Hmm. There is some speculation that the 1918 pandemic originated in the U.S., I've done some writing on the subject, so I've had to do some research on the subject. But there's good evidence that that as well came from China. These public health problems generally don't originate in this country, and there's a reason for that, or in Western Europe.
It's good to keep these things in perspective. And I appreciated the point that you made about how in generations past, there was absolutely no option whatsoever of doing your work from home. such a thing, it was unthinkable. And so the fact that so many of us can continue to function and so many of our businesses can continue to function as we are is something that we should not take for granted. Not that there aren't a whole lot of unemployed people right now, and not that there hasn't been terrible damage done to our economy.
No.
We do need to keep it in perspective. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clawson Center at Carthage College. I want to just get a quick assessment from you of how our economy is doing in the wake of COVID-19 thus far.
I myself am amazed that the markets have stayed as strong as they are. The federal government has, to an unprecedented degree, even more than during the financial crash of 2007, 2008, and 2009 to a degree, I think, the tremendous relief efforts of the federal government, plus the fact that nonprofit organizations, nonprofits, not business, not government, not the church, they're a distinctively Anglo-American institution. And there are a lot more of them than there used to be. And I believe overall there are simply more resources to help people economically. We still haven't surpassed or surpassed much the enormous debt levels that we had at the end of World War II. So I believe, given the tremendous growth engine of this country and increasingly others in the world, especially the United States economy since 1940, I think we can handle this. And certain businesses are booming. You know, Amazon, those folks are getting richer than they were even before. And more opportunity for Mr. Bezos to do even more good works, I hope. My middle son, Tom, has a very good job with Mariano's food stores, now part of the Kroger Company, which has been around since 1883, still stand alone. And thanks to him, I've learned, gotten some insight as to why. Their business is booming and they're hiring. Delivery services and lots of others. There are a lot of people who are hurting and a lot of small businesses. We all see storefronts that used to be a restaurant or used to be a small retail outlet that are gone and they won't come back, but it's very disruptive. But overall, I don't think we have the Great Depression or place bets, depending on what this guy Sear thinks about the world. But overall, we're quite strong. And as I say, I've been impressed that stocks haven't gone lower globally. Again, I don't want to go off on another tangent, but since the 1950s and the development of mutual funds, capital has been not only more and more plentiful, but less and less connected with particular companies. And I think the fact that there is so much investment capital in the world compared to earlier times, and it's potentially dangerous, as we saw in 2007-08 and in the dot-com crash, in terms of a crash, but overall, there's so much liquid capital. That's a big factor, I think, in why the markets have held up. I know the media is full of alarm about speculation, but when you look at price earnings ratios, especially the S&P, that has a year lag, a year average, we're not in the middle of the speculative fever of the turn of the century or just before the last financial crash. We may get there, but we're not in that kind of environment now. And I, like you, I'm lucky. I got a paycheck, and I'm employed for the moment. And it's easy to be optimistic when, and most of my parental responsibilities are behind me. So that I don't minimize the fact that there are a lot of people hurting.
Let's talk for a moment about a couple of setbacks for President Trump at the hands of the Supreme Court. Two different decisions were handed down from a largely conservative Supreme Court, one regarding the access of transgender people to healthcare benefits, the other involving the ending of DACA. And in both of these cases, the Supreme Court, in a sense, turned back moves that President Trump wanted. And this caught a lot of people by surprise. I mean, kind of assuming that a conservative Supreme Court would not, in a sense, say no to President Trump. Were you surprised by one or both of those decisions, or is it too simplistic to call the Supreme Court a conservative court at the moment?
I think your last point is the most important. The founders, quite brilliantly, and the older I get, the more brilliant they appear to me. It's very difficult to get anything done dramatically at the national level in this country, in great contrast to others, including our British friends, who can make profound decisions very quickly. And the Brexit mess that they've been mired in for the last 5 years reflects the dangers of that. I happen to personally agree with the Supreme Court decisions, but what's of greater consequence is the fact that they're really showing their independence as a separate branch. And conservative justices have made this point, and I agree with it. The fact that the Supreme Court gets involved so much in policy issues that are divisive reflects the fact that the Congress has not been the disciplined legislative branch that it should be. And they weren't the good old days, but Congress used to take these responsibilities more seriously. The last time we had a federal budget process initiated in the House, but driven by the White House, that actually worked was in 1996.
Wow.
The so-called modernist, and reflects Bill Clinton's political genius as an amazing deal maker in terms of that kind of politics, as well as disciplined leadership in the House and Senate. The last time we had a budget come in on time was in 2008. I did a little research on the subject. Speaker Pelosi, it's all to the good that she banned smoking and drinking in the Capitol. It's you can have your own opinion about what removing portraits of House speakers who were associated in one way or another with the Confederate States. These symbolic gestures, which are so popular today. Meanwhile, the House has totally abandoned its responsibilities for any kind of orderly budget process. The earlier period wasn't better or more desirable than the way we operate today. Politicians can get away with this because our country is so wealthy. But I hope Congress collectively, especially the House, will assert itself in serious adult ways, and I hope the near future. And I think there's room for politicians to get ahead if they can emphasize bipartisanship. I think the rapid growth in the proportion of women in the Congress, now more than 100, and this is a long-term trend that's in denial, and a quarter of the U.S. Senate is now female. I think that actually is a positive factor, not just because it's the correct thing to say nowadays, but women tend to work more together across these partisan divides. You can see it in all kinds of ways in the way the Congress is functioning today.
Glad to have some reason for hope for a more functional rather than dysfunctional Congress.
And it's certainly good that we have overall a female Speaker of the House of Representatives on the off chance that Speaker Pelosi might be listening to the morning show. All of this is very positive, but what Lyndon Johnson, Sam Rayburn, what earlier generations, even Paul Ryan, until he finally went mad, I think, through frustration in the political sense, you know, what used to be considered your responsibility is just gone by the boards.
Interesting.
Now, the Supreme Court is doing more than it should do, in my view. But I happen to agree with the two decisions. I also think they will help Trump with his dedicated base in the next election, the more he can point to the permanent government or the great conspiracy or the swamp frustrating his efforts. I think that will actually help him with his most dedicated followers.
Let's talk for a moment about your column you wrote about the Arctic. This is something that we don't tend to hear very much about, especially if we only very vaguely follow the news.
Subject.
But you were you're talking about the United States and Britain engaging in some one writer called Cold War games with Russia in the Arctic region. So what's unfolding up there that we need to be paying attention to?
Both sides are doing it. I was quoting an article headline from The Economist, a very worthwhile weekly, but I believe the Russians were assertive before we were. Historically, the British, who actually did kind of run the world more or less for a couple hundred years, have been very active in organizing exploration and also management of both poles, North and South. We succeeded them sort of for a time, but in recent decades, especially since the end of the Cold War, we've been almost inert, especially during the Obama and Trump administrations. President Obama made a trip to the polar regions, to Alaska, and praised Native Americans, and I believe changed the name of a mountain to one that's more acceptable to the political left, but there was nothing in terms of policy, except for middle-level people in the State Department. Meanwhile, Russia and increasingly China have been very, very active in that part of the world. The Chinese are buying up enormous amounts of natural resources, including valuable minerals and forest areas that are being freed up by the melting polar ice cap. And the fact that the global warming has affected the Arctic. And the Russians are organizing on a regular basis major conferences that bring together not just political and diplomatic types, but business investors, military people. These two major powers are asserting themselves in a time when the Americans seem to be simply inert in terms of any policy leadership. We have exercised significant strategic leadership in the past, not entirely military, but the demilitarization of Antarctica by Eisenhower in 1959 was the first of the post-World War II arms control agreements that was really significant. President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev deserve great credit for the limited nuclear test ban treaty in 1963, which was rightly celebrated in public. It was a capstone of IGGY, the International Geophysical Year, in 58, 59, I think, which the Eisenhower administration organized in terms of international law, international cooperation related to the two poles. That administration deserves great credit for, in a disciplined, comprehensive way, carrying on what the British had been doing literally for hundreds of years. The new nuclear submarine, the Nautilus, and these strategic submarines, when carrying nuclear weapons, are literally invulnerable. The most important part of our strategic nuclear deterrent, which remains very important despite the end of the Cold War, Eisenhower sent it under the North Pole. Other people had been to the North Pole and flown over it, but this was the first voyage that went literally under the North Pole. The voyage went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. Ike was, along with more positive efforts, he was telling the Kremlin, look, this is what we can do. This is evidence of the kind of thing we can do to you if necessary. And I assure you, then as now, the Russians quite rightly remain not only intimidated, but essentially frightened by the power of American military technology. There are lots of things important related to the two poles. And at the moment, I'm sorry to say, we're not doing anything as a government.
Yeah. I know that you devoted a column to Dwight D. Eisenhower, someone you very greatly admire. And we don't have a lot of time to talk about him specifically, but I do want to draw one point out of your column and give you a chance to expand on it. And
Thank you.
This is when you say that Eisenhower was a supremely gifted leader of Americans and others as well. He demonstrated public modesty, but when necessary, also employed an iron fist. And I suspect that what you're trying to convey there is that is an uncommon combination. We don't often think of somebody who demonstrates modesty also having this real strength and fire of being, in a sense, capable of or possessing both temperaments. And evidently, Eisenhower did.
Yes, nothing went wrong. There were crises, but he ended the Korean War, kept the peace for two terms. There were some scandals, nothing of any consequence. I mentioned before, he was remarkably cold-blooded. That was a statement from his son, John Eisenhower, who was a successful military officer, author, and business executive in his own right. Thanks to both father and son, John Eisenhower was able to get out from underneath his dad and achieve a successful life on his own. A real tribute to both of them. But he was once asked, how would you sum up your dad? And he said, cold-blooded after a while. Eisenhower was very loyal to his family, contrary to gossip that you may have run across. He had a lot of personal integrity, but he was extraordinarily ruthless. And that was a big reason why Roosevelt and Marshall picked him for the invasion of Africa. We were losing the war. We might well lose the war. They jumped Ike over literally a couple of hundred more senior officers. He had just gotten his first star as a brigadier general. He liked to pretend that he wasn't a good student. He wasn't at West Point, but he was at the top of his class and all the endless army training schools and regimes after that. But the other point that FDR and Marshall agreed on was that people want to follow him. The thing about him is people want to follow him. And I think it was that combination of competence, warmth, in a personal terms of a rather calculated sort, and commitment to duty that really drew people, contrary to the public image that he liked to cultivate during his time in the White House. So, you know, leaders who are durable and are not seen to be that way necessarily at the time are the ones worth studying. I'm very glad that there's a U.S. Grant renaissance coming up. I'm particularly proud of an article I was finally able to get published in the journal Infantry at Fort Benning, Georgia, this year about Grant. Another example, a less successful president, but a general that we've tended to overlook. A very American military leader. These people are very American. They're not flamboyant. They don't strut around. Both Grant and Eisenhower, when other officers were real peacocks in terms of their wardrobes and public behavior, they were democratic, down-to-earth, modest, and they constantly emphasized the importance of unit cohesion and giving credit to others. That's something distinctively American, I think. And one reason why democracies prevail, ultimately, if they can hold out long enough. I'm very glad you asked about complimentary sword, which is unusual. People often write to raise hell or complain or make threats, but I've gotten some very positive feedback concerning that Eisenhower column, including from you.
Right. Eisenhower figures in a book that I'm highlighting later this week on the morning show, a conversation I recorded with John Feerick, who is a former dean of the Fordham Law School, and one of the primary authors of the wording of the 25th Amendment, which is that amendment to the Constitution, which stipulates what happens when a president finds themselves disabled, as has happened several times in our history, of course, with Garfield after he was shot, and Wilson after his stroke, and Eisenhower hospitalized, I think, a couple of different times during his administration, although those were not lengthy periods of, and maybe he was never actually, in fact, disabled in a sense that those earlier two presidents were. But
Well, he had heart attacks, and those were serious. You're quite right to include him, more traumatic as the others, but I tell you, it's a compliment to the faith of the American people that they reelected him in 56 after a heart attack.
He had this
incredible hold on the electorate.
One of the things that's interesting about this book by Mr. Feerick is that he kind of spells out how complicated it is to lay out the language, to lay out the verbiage for what do we do when a president is disabled. And at a glance, that would seem like a very simple matter, but there are all kinds of sort of smaller questions within that larger question of what do we do and how do we do it when these situations arise. And it sort of speaks to the importance of thinking about details and yet not writing every possible detail into an amendment. It's just one of those things that most of us don't give much thought to.
Well, it's a credit to you and to him that you're discussing it. A terrible tragedy you didn't mention was the assassination of John Kennedy. President Truman, another very honest leader, I, as I understand the history, he had sponsored legislation to interpose the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the President pro tem of the Senate between the Vice President and the rest of the Cabinet. Truman, another very honest man, was very sensitive about cronyism, given his origins in the Kansas City political machine, Pendergast. So he put that in law. When President Kennedy was murdered, the Speaker of the House of Representatives was John McCormick, an old-time Boston politician. Interesting, in many ways admirable, but he was in his 70s, which was quite old at the time. And Carl Hayden, the President pro tem of the Senate, was in his 80s
at
the time. He, a Democrat who'd entered the Senate in the 1920s.
Wow.
And after this terrible, truly shocking trauma of Kennedy's assassination, If anything should happen to Lyndon Johnson, we got these two really old guys who really aren't representative of the current America. And all of that fed into what do we do about the 20, how do we handle presidential succession? And it was timely, given the Watergate crisis, which led to the resignation eventually of President Nixon, but Vice President Agnew had to be removed for corruption, and then Nelson Rockefeller became vice president, and he didn't work out. So we got Gerald Ford, who was a great successor to Nixon, in my view. Mm-hmm. And Nixon picked him, I think, for all the right reasons, in a curious way, saw his own demise coming and his own flaws. But it's a very worthwhile amendment. And thank God, another big difference between then and now is that the 60s were the one decade in my life when I thought our country was coming apart. These assassinations were horrible. Both Kennedy brothers plus Dr. King, and violence seemed to be everywhere. George Wallace was a very, very dangerous, very destructive figure. And I don't minimize the negative aspects of President Trump, especially on public radio, but there's no figure like Wallace. A truly brilliant, truly destructive and negative politician who came very close to throwing the 68 election into the House of Representatives.
Tumultuous times, and it's...
It was, and very different from today.
Absolutely.
Even though I know a lot of people are concerned and upset, and should be, about aspects of current developments, I am, but it's not like it was then. Beyond certain people who like to be in the public eye and have extreme rhetoric, who do you know that really believes the country is literally falling apart? Probably not many people, even in public radio.
Well, the next time we have a conversation, we may talk, among other things, about John Bolton's book. Do you have any plans to read that book once it becomes available, if it becomes available?
I'm very proud of the fact, I hope I don't dislocate my arm patting myself on the back. I write regular book reviews, including for professional publications, as well as the weekly column. It's important in academic life, and I've been able to do it, and I'm glad. So publishers now send me things. And Simon & Schuster, I got an email from a vice president, no less, in response to mine, saying, yes, we'll get this to you by postal mail. So apparently the White House is not going to succeed.
Yeah.
And apparently I'll have plenty to say.
Yeah.
You ought to get John Bolton on your program. He has plenty to say.
There you go. Well, we'll see about that. But in the meantime, I'll look forward to having you back in the month of July. Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage. It's always great to speak with you. I appreciate you making time for this conversation and look forward to reconnecting with you soon. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you, Greg. Be well. Take care. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we're scheduled to have a new conversation with Corey Mason, the mayor of the city of Racine. And of course, there will be plenty to talk about with Mayor Mason, and we appreciate him making time in his very busy schedule for the morning show. Tomorrow's morning show is also supposed to include a conversation with TV journalist Soledad O'Brien. She is the producer of a new documentary about the COVID-19 crisis, which focuses in particular on some of the special difficulties that were faced by the city of Seattle in the early days of the crisis. That documentary airs tomorrow night on WISN in Milwaukee, and we hope to have a conversation with Soledad O'Brien as also part of tomorrow's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape custom career development plan from their first days on campus.
Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. We're approaching 9 o'clock.